Welcome to Cyber Frontier, bringing you the latest news, trends, and hottest topics that focus on advances in cybersecurity and cyber industry economics. Our expert yet down-to-earth hosts make cybersecurity straightforward. They ask the tough questions and make this challenging topic something that everyone can understand. Our candid approach lets guests open up on topics we would all like to see addressed. You can find us on the web at newcyberfrontier.com. That's www.newcyberfrontier.com. Now join today's host as he introduces the topic for today's New Cyber Frontier.
Welcome to today's episode of New Cyber Frontier. On today we have Michael Eccles, a cyber evangelist, self-proclaimed, and his company, Max Cybersecurity. Now, Michael has a background as he also leads a nonprofit out of Kennedy Space Center, the International Association of Certified ISOWs. And in his background as a cyber director, a chair of the DHS communications sector, so for the DHS, and also an author, and spent some time working for the White House. So the book you wrote is called Secure Cyber Life, The Government Is Not Going to Save You. Welcome today, Michael.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
Definitely. And I am so interested to talk about this book because I think it's right on spot. The title at least starts the conversation. You know, the government's not here to save us from this. So we're gonna peel into that as we go today. But first of all, give us your background. I know I kind of gave you have so many things from your career, your life, and now published author in the cybersecurity realm. But give us your background of how you got to where you're at.
Sure. I spent the early part of my career working in telecommunications, chasing phone hackers and computer hackers and building fiber networks across the country. After 9/11, I started working for TSA, Transportation Security Administration, when that was stood up. One of the things I was able to do is to help solve the interoperability issue that we saw with the attack on 9/11 and firefighters, federal people. They were all talking on different networks. And I was able to prove out a concept using handheld devices. And this was prior to our use of cell phones. It doesn't seem like that long ago, but we haven't had cell phones, smartphones, for that long. I later worked through different opportunities at the Department of Homeland Security, helping to build a national infrastructure protection program, helping to build a national response framework. And what that framework is when you see a major disaster, it's how all of the organizations come together to respond, whether it's a hurricane, the tornadoes, all of those types of things. FEMA leads that type of response. And so as I progressed through my career at the Department of Homeland Security, I became the chair of the communication sector, one of 16 critical sectors. I helped to build the NIST cybersecurity framework. I helped to roll out a new concept for cyber threat information sharing, which was launched by the White House. I was a point person at the Department of Homeland Security. And somewhere in between there, I was a rep to NATO for communications and cyber.
Interesting.
And now, in the private sector, I'm trying to carry on many of the things that I felt we needed to do to help make communities and individuals more resilient across the nation.
Interesting. So were you always interested in cyber? How did you get into that? Like somebody coming out of high school, out of college, you know, what was your interest like back at that point?
So I wasn't always interested in cyber because there was no such thing as cyber. Cyber is a buzzword, and cyber guys hate for me to say that when I speak at conferences, but it's a buzzword, which is the amalgamation of the training, the tools, the communication, the partnership, all of those things add up to cybersecurity, right? And without all of them, including the risk management piece, you can't say you're doing cybersecurity. And so back early in time, they called it information assurance. And there was this physical security piece. But for me, coming out of high school, I just had curiosity and an interest in stopping the bad guy.
Interesting. Well, let's take a break. We'll be right back after we hear from our sponsors.
Cyber Resilience Institute helps build strong cyber communities designed to prevent members from attack. Like building a neighborhood watch, it takes coordination and a sharing community to protect our identities and valuables in the virtual world. Typically, we hear that organizations know they need to do something to protect their cyber assets, but don't know where to begin. Let Cyber Resilience Institute help your community create an action plan. Cyber Resilience Institute will build your community or business marketplace so that it is designed to support a collective cyber defense. Contact them for more information at cyberresilienceinstitute.org.
Welcome back to New Cyber Frontier. On today with Michael Eccles. And before the break, you had talked about cybersecurity as a buzzword. All right. And it used to be called, it's kind of an amalgamation.
Information assurance.
Of different things. So if you had to say, what would you call it? Is there a better kind of term that you would use for this whole new evolving industry?
Absolutely not. Cybersecurity is a great word, but it's just one of those things that needs some understanding. One of the very interesting things that one of my former Secret Service colleagues used to say is, if you went into a high school physics class, mm-hmm. and you asked every student, what is force? Mass times acceleration, right? You go to any college, the physics students will tell you that. If you go to a room of cybersecurity experts, 50 people in a room, you'll get 42 different answers about what cybersecurity is. That's one of the issues that defines our inability to protect assets, networks, and systems.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And you know, the thing I've seen also is that usually, you know, in the past, the cybersecurity people were the person that had been with the company, with the industry for 20 years before they got all the pieces of knowledge. And now we're trying to train people out of college to do that same thing. So we have to kind of specialize them in one thing, or what they're going to be targeted on, what they're going to actually do for the job, instead of, you know, that bigger picture. But I think you're right. It's just, it's the whole infrastructure of, I heard one person talk to explain it as, if you're making a cake, you got all those ingredients, no matter what cake you're making, cybersecurity is like the water. It holds everything together and makes it all work.
Yeah, and if you extrapolate from that, now take it to a level where the individuals who are part of our society, who are entrusted with our data, who work in some of these critical facilities, we have an expectation that they will do the right thing, because many of the cyber issues evolve from human error, right? Mm-hmm. So we have this expectation that they will, one, do the right thing, no different than you expect for the people who are fixing your food at the restaurant to wash their hands, right? So there are all of these practices that we have an expectation of. However, we have not prepared the people to play their role in protecting this digital infrastructure that serves us all. Mm-hmm. And oh, by the way, while we are already behind, we are now producing new technologies. We are producing new concepts. And for instance, I'll give you one. Smart cities. We will begin to implement smart cities for security and convenience. The key here is that we will be pushing a lot of data. And as we push that data, there is a potential exposure for personal information, but also keys to the city, essentially. Mm-hmm. And if we can't protect these singular individual systems and assets right now, why would we build a powder keg where the consequences are even greater if they're hacked.
Mm-hmm. You know, though, if you think about the human nature behind that, every sci-fi movie I think I've ever seen about the future talks about computers, robots taking over, some kind of a Skynet, right? But it still doesn't stop people's mad push to get that to happen. We don't back off one iota.
And thus, the backbone of capitalism. So we are so good and we are so much ahead of the rest of the world in so many ways because we allow people the freedom to imagine and to grow and to try things and to put things together and to work with other people and to take two very different ideas and merge them together. And that makes us great. But at the same time, the fact that we don't have a lot of regulations, that there are probably 47 different sets of rules and laws about breach reporting across this country. 50 states, 47 different sets of rules. That freedom is wonderful. But when it comes to systems that are all connected to each other, it's critical that we finally find some leadership.
Yeah. So, but leadership, that's the government, right? They're going to save us.
That's the problem. So everybody assumes that the government serves that role. But if you talk to the government, they will tell you that, hey, we have a role of government. They will tell you that we protect the .gov. We assist to protect the .mil, which is the military, right? Military has their own systems. And they will also tell you that we assist to protect the .com. And that's all of the private sector entities. The private sector entities, for the most part, push back on the government because they don't want to be regulated, because they want those freedoms, right? But this sets up a very interesting dynamic. So the people, the small businesses and organizations want and need to be protected. The biggest companies don't want regulation, but the biggest companies have the greatest voice, right? They lobby Congress, they fund campaigns. They're the ones who are sitting planning with the government for the rollout of new technologies, right? And so what happens is there's an imbalance and there are sets or components of individuals, organizations, small businesses, people across the nation who are not getting what they need to protect themselves. Mm-hmm. And oh, by the way, that includes protecting themselves from those same very large companies.
Interesting.
Many of the largest companies use the same techniques that hackers use. Whether it comes from adware, collecting your data, walking you into situations where they have control of your digital life, because in order to use their system, you've signed away your rights. All of these dynamics are happening at one time, and they define our cyber conundrum.
So that dynamic of, we'll say, the individual average citizen and the big company, would you say that the big companies benefit from the current environment where there isn't regulation and they actually push against protecting their individuals that might be their customers?
Absolutely. The big companies benefit not just from not being regulated, but they benefit from the ignorance of the average person about their digital world. Most of us understand to some extent something about the environment, because from a child, we grow up understanding that, hey, we need oxygen to live. Hey, if you have too much of other stuff, it could cause you to pass out, you know? Hey, so you learn these things as a matter of your culture. With cybersecurity, we aren't there yet. So these things are happening to people before the next generation potentially has the chance to push back, because they have a greater understanding of what's going on around them. We really haven't seen a lot of personal information, protection, data control types of activism, right? We see it from organizations, but that great push from society has not occurred. Let me give you one perspective. If companies make money from selling our information, wouldn't it be great if we had an exchange where we could make money from selling our information?
Interesting.
Some would say that that already sort of occurs when you sign up and you receive a service for free, like Facebook, like Twitter, any of the social media platforms, but also many of the other free services that you get on the internet. A lot of people believe that you are benefiting or you're getting that service for free. That is your payment.
Let's take a break, hear from our sponsors. We'll be right back to Unpeel That. Cyber Frontier. On today, talking with Michael Eccles, and a great comment you were making before the break here, and I wanted to unpeel that a little bit, where people think that they're buying, you know, they sign up for Facebook, that they're buying that information exchange, right? But they're paying with something. What are they paying with?
So the issue is they think they're just paying with their data to be passed on or sold potentially to another partner of that company. The issue in the big picture is that, and if I could digress for a second, the big picture is, for instance, when a breach occurs. When a breach occurs, the company that's breached is not the victim. Your information being stolen, no different than your information being voluntarily passed on to these big companies, in the future will potentially make you the victim, right? I saw last year where Facebook, for instance, was trying to partner with the largest bank in a country to share information about customers. That scares me, right? That your banking, the support that you're getting from a very institutional standpoint is now being communicated and shared with a social media entity. From another perspective, in New York last year, insurance companies were trying to get the right to use your social media profile to determine whether or how much you're charged for insurance. These types of engagements and conjoining of different aspects of our society makes that futuristic world that you were talking about before very, very possible. Because let's take those situations, add in artificial intelligence. Well, artificial intelligence, depending on who programmed it and how they programmed it, it creates larger biases from the bias that was programmed into it. So my point is that you take these varying different things that do not appear to touch, and they become a constellation where they all touch. And before long, we are, and I could never say this kind of thing as a government official, and that's why I love being an independent person now. We potentially become digital slaves. That's powerful.
That is. It's almost like a moment of silence right here. Because, you know, we're a blackmail away from AI to holding whatever it can find negative or correlate over our heads.
Correct. Now let's add in a piece here. We are all defined by an algorithm right now. It's probably the simplest algorithm ever created. It's called your social security number. It defines your identity. When you go to sign up for something, to get government service, to even receive social security checks in your retirement, they use your social security number. In the future, as we continue to be digitized, we're all going to be an algorithm online. Mm-hmm. Well, we can't even protect the data that's online now. The internet was never designed to be secure, right? So what happens when your algorithm online is corrupted? Is it those future societies where there are people who walk among the daywalkers, or the people that are all sort of underground because they can't find their way back into what we define as society because their algorithm is corrupted? Who they are is defined as something that's potentially not accurate or mm-hmm. wrong. Now, the issue for me as a young man who grew up or was born in Birmingham, Alabama, during the civil rights movement, the issue for me is that if you're wealthy, you can find the services to help you restore your identity. If you're not, it creates a potentially lifelong and generational issue.
Mm-hmm. So I have a kind of a question for you. I want to hear you talk to the people who would do this. People, and I'll give you an example. Right now, you can get a little thing to put in your car for your insurance company that gives you a 15% discount if you let them track everywhere you go and you're driving. Now, for 90% of the people, this makes their insurance cheaper. But it's that outlier that you talk about that gets themselves into some situation that they might never be able to crawl out of that hole, that is punished or that never can come back into society, as you said. What do you say to that 90% of the people that would gladly give up some aspect to get a little bit cheaper services?
So let me start this off by saying, I love being an American. I love the freedom that we have. And then the second thing I would say is that's why I define cybersecurity as risk management. In every situation, from a national network down to an individual making a decision, we all have to make a risk decision. But that risk decision should be informed by understanding of the consequences, right? If you don't understand the consequences, which is vulnerability, threats, and consequences, if you don't understand that, you can't do risk management, right? And so we should be doing this digital risk management for ourselves on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. Now, in the situation that you are speaking of, the opportunity to save money is a risk decision that a lot of people would make, right? But that decision should be made based on you understanding that all of the data that's created no longer belongs to you and can be used against you.
Can be.
Consequences.
But that 90% that sees, I don't have anything to hide, it'll never be used against me, make the boundaries of the whole system for everybody. What do you say
right.
to that?
No, you know, that phrase that you just used, because everybody says that, I don't have anything to hide. Well, let's think about when that's one of those phrases, like when people get stopped for drunk or out driving and they walk up, the first thing that they always say to the police officer is, oh, I've only had one or two, right? That's one of those societal phrases, I don't have anything to hide. It's not about what you have to hide. It's about the data and information belongs to you And that data and information can be used against you. And I will give you an example. In this particular case, it worked and served to help society. But the police solved their first case using Alexa a couple of years ago, and this is in the book, because there was a Alexa records even when you don't ask it to record. And it was a murder case. And they were actually able to go back through subpoenas and get the information and listen to what was going on at that time period, at that location, in that person's home.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting because, you know, we have some rights guaranteed in our home. And I'm trying to think of the precedents for that, but
no illegal search and seizure.
Yes. Yes. So,
and the other rule says that you have to, but once you give them permission, right? Once you give them permission, and we think about that when we're in those circumstances, when the police come, you said, nope, I don't want you searching my vehicle. Nope, I don't want you searching my home. Nope, right? We're making a risk decision at that moment. Mm-hmm. My point is simply that when it comes to these digital systems, you've signed away your rights without understanding the specific situation.
So you've given up your right by buying an Alexa. It's in your home. You've signed that away and given it to Amazon.
Correct.
Also, moment of silence right there. How many people would think about that a little bit right there? So let's step back and say, wow, we've had a couple eye-opening thoughts here talked about today. What's the recommendation for moving forward? How can people start to identify, proceed, and move into something that makes sense?
So we need to start to build, and I'm speaking from a national level now. One of the things that I've figured out clearly is that the federal government cannot mandate, they cannot build this secure world that we're looking for so that we can maintain our way of life. It has to be a partnership between government and private sector. All of the best programs that have ever been done were public-private partnerships. Mm-hmm. Everything from Energy Star, where, you know, the manufacturers all lowered, they weren't regulated, they lowered the outputs of these systems, all the way to some of the state and local programs. Speaking of state and locals, hey, federal government, state and locals have to be involved. So I've come up with a process, program, system called cybersecurity zones. And I'm working with organizations like NTIA, the Department of Commerce, HUD, and Department of Homeland Security, to figure out how we start building these cybersecurity zones in places across the nation. What is a cybersecurity zone? Well, it's an ecosystem where there is an expectation of a culture of cybersecurity. But the only way for us to do that is there has to be win-wins. So what do the win-wins look like? One, we are giving children who are in high school and middle school some principles for protecting themselves, right? But we're having cyber students who are in college to do that training. What do they get from that? Well, those cyber students who are in college are having trouble finding jobs, even though there is a 1.8 million person projected shortage of cyber professionals. The reason that has been identified, hey, we need people with some experience. We're now setting those college students up to have experience, but they're getting that experience by helping society, right? Additionally, small businesses. The federal government puts out so many great products. Some of those are for risk management, for self-assessment. they never make it to the small business because they don't understand the benefits of doing a risk assessment. They don't understand how to use some of these tools, right? And so by having a cyber secure zone, a center, a brand in that area, they are now promoting this to small businesses. They're helping the small business do those assessments, which help protect themselves. And the opportunity to create a place for all of those federal funds and grants that in a lot of cases go untapped. We can now direct those funds to a central place in a community that creates an opportunity to work across all of the community components, schools, local governments, small businesses, critical infrastructure, and to get the outcomes that we're looking for. We're not just shooting in the dark. Mm-hmm. And so this idea of creating a culture of cybersecurity puts the onus back on the local community to protect themselves.
Interesting.
That's how we win this.
Awesome. So kind of we're running into our time here, but in closing, tell us how people can get more information. Who can reach out to you? Who do you need to be involved with your efforts?
I am a guy that will talk to everybody and anybody. You can reach me at mechols@maxcybersecurity.com, mechols@maxcybersecurity.com. You can find me on LinkedIn, and you can also catch me on Twitter at TRYDC, TryDC, at TryDC.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining today, Michael. It's definitely been a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. Have a good one.
Thank you for listening to New Cyber Frontier. Remember to follow or like our post and circulate each new show to your networks. We keep you informed, bring you the latest news, explore new trends, and find the hottest topics. With New Cyber Frontier, you don't have to be a computer or cybersecurity expert. Just get plugged in. We encourage you to get involved. Tell us what topics interest you and join our mailing lists. You can find us on the web at www.newcyberfrontier.com. That's newcyberfrontier.com. Check out our previous interviews and please let us know if there are any topics that you would like to hear discussed. See you next time on New Cyber Frontier.